This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at some recent First Amendment cases involving religious freedom. Religion is more and more being used as an excuse to discriminate against certain groups and to deny them services and actually disobey U.S. laws. We also hear from an alternative 4th of July celebration that took place in New York City on July 3rd. It commemorated Frederick Douglass and his Independence Day speech at the Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society back in 1852. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. On the final day of the 2018 Supreme Court term, Justice Elena Kagan said that conservatives are, quote, weaponizing the First Amendment and turning it into a sword. Many on the left, who once held absolutist views on free speech, are realizing that certain court victories may actually bring harms to women, gay and lesbian couples, and others, rather than advancing their causes. The same is true with some cases involving religious freedom. The Washington, D.C.-based group Americans United for the Separation of Church and State says, in part, on its website, that, quote, religion is often used as an excuse to discriminate against LGBTQ people, women, religious minorities, non-believers, and others. Some want to use their religious beliefs as an excuse to deny health care, refuse to provide goods and services, and disobey laws protecting Americans from discrimination. Joining us to discuss trends in First Amendment Establishment Clause cases is Richard Katzke, legal director at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Richard has litigated First Amendment cases in appellate and trial courts across the country, including challenging creationism in the public schools, religiously based discrimination against same-sex couples, the presentation of official prayer at governmental meetings and functions, and the provision of federal funding to faith-based organizations. He is a Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow and a regular speaker at universities and legal, educational, and scientific associations across the country. Richard Katzke, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
The Constitution's phrase, separation of church and state, is actually paraphrased from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote, and he was echoing the language of Roger Williams, who was the founder of the First Baptist Church. And Williams wrote in 1644, quote, a hedge or wall of separation between the garden of the church and the wilderness of the world. And that wall language has been cited repeatedly by the U.S. Supreme Court. In your legal experience, how is this wall standing up?
Honestly, I think that we've lost our way. It's really under attack. And I tell you, I'm so glad that you brought up Roger Williams, who also founded Rhode Island.
Right.
If you'll forgive me for just a minute on history, Williams taught that religious belief is valid and true only if you come to it entirely on your own. When government coerces religious belief or even just gives benefits or shows favoritism toward any faith or any house of worship, that interferes with individuals' decisions on matters of conscience. And he also thought that when government gives money or other support to churches or denominations, religion ends up being degraded because churches and religious groups, they change their behavior, they distort their doctrine, they corrupt their prophetic voice to try to get more goodies from the government. Enlightenment philosopher John Locke taught the other half of the equation, where he said that religion and government should be kept separate, not just to protect religion, but to protect against religious authorities imposing their will through the government, because that's a tool that's been historically a tool of oppression. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison put the lessons of Williams and Locke together, and they gave us this concept of the wall of separation as the way to protect religious freedom for everybody. A generation or two ago, that was considered the traditional, fundamental, conservative American value, because it's the way that we can all live together in relative peace and harmony, despite enormous and increasing religious pluralism. But today, language of religious freedom, it's being co-opted. Instead of being about the freedom to worship or not, to practice your faith or not, according to the dictates of conscience, we see assertions in the name of religious liberty of the rights to discriminate, to deny other people their rights, to impose beliefs and favored practices of a politically powerful majority on the rest of us. Those are just the things that Williams and Locke and Jefferson and Madison worked so hard to prevent, and that's what we're seeing today.
Well, that leads nicely into the recent decision in the case Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission and its potential impact on LGBT rights and discrimination. Can you talk a bit about that?
Oh, sure. I know your audience is incredibly well informed. A quick recap is that Charlie Craig and David Mullen, who are a couple in Colorado, went into a bakery, actually with Charlie's mom, to pick out a wedding cake. And the owner of the bakery, when he found out that it was a same-sex couple, said, "No, I don't do that. I won't make wedding cakes for you," and turned them away. The state ended up enforcing its anti-discrimination law against the bakery. The anti-discrimination law at issue in Masterpiece actually dates back to 1885, when it was just about race. The state, very early on, after not too long after the Civil War, passed a law saying that if you're a business open to the public, a restaurant, a hotel, something like that, you can't turn away people based on race. Little by little, over the next, whatever it's been, well over a century now, the state has added other protected classifications: religion, national origin, sex, and most recently added sexual orientation, saying you can't discriminate against LGBT people either. The bakery in Masterpiece argued that it had free speech and religious freedom rights to violate that anti-discrimination law. They argued that baking wedding cakes is art and that they should have constitutional rights not to bake a cake for a wedding of a same-sex couple, because if they did, that would be putting their art to work for something that they believe that violates their religious beliefs. Now, in a case in 1968 called Piggy Park, the Supreme Court heard just the same argument by a restaurant owner who was challenging a portion of the Federal Civil Rights Act, making it unlawful to refuse to serve African Americans. The restaurant owner then said that the Civil Rights Act should be invalid because it contravenes the will of God. And the Supreme Court said that argument was patently frivolous. Now, it didn't say that the restaurant owner's religious beliefs weren't genuine. It didn't say that the restaurant owner wasn't entitled to those beliefs, but the court made it clear that your religious beliefs don't give you a free pass to violate anti-discrimination laws and to hurt other people in doing so. And that's what's at stake in Masterpiece. But the Supreme Court didn't actually decide any of those big questions. We thought that it would. Instead, the majority held that because of some statements, basically one statement, by a member of a state commission that initially investigated the discrimination claim against the bakery, the enforcement of the anti-discrimination law was basically, the court thought, irretrievably tainted with religious bias. What the commissioner said was essentially, people have used claims of religious freedom throughout history to justify discrimination and slavery, and there's something wrong with you using religious claims to hurt others. The majority opinion by Justice Kennedy treats that statement as odious religious discrimination that's just unconscionable. I have to tell you, though, I've shown that statement to a lot of clergy members since the oral argument in Masterpiece in December, when it became clear that Justice Kennedy was really bothered by it. And what all the clergy I talked to said is they looked at that commissioner's statement and said, it's just true. It's not discriminatory or insulting to religion. Religion does a lot of good for a lot of people, but historically religious claims have also been used to try to justify discrimination and to harm people. Now, with the court's decision, the lower courts are going to have to go back and figure out whether, for the first time in our history, we're going to start recognizing that my religious beliefs give me the right to discriminate, to violate anti-discrimination laws, whether I can refuse to serve people based on sexual orientation, or for that matter, religion or race, if I invoke a religious reason for doing so. That's never been what religious freedom means. It's divisive. It denies basic dignity and equal status as citizens, and it goes against the basic idea that the law applies to everyone. Religious freedom, free exercise, that's not what it's supposed to be about.
That's interesting. I'm thinking that in a way, religious freedom is, it's highly personal. Sort of, it attaches to the person. And perhaps when you engage in, as in this case, a commercial interaction, it wasn't meant to go that far.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's what the law has always been, is to say your beliefs are your own, your religious practices are your own, and if there are people whom you object to or people's actions you object to based on your religion, don't invite them to your home. Don't see them socially. But if you run a business open to the public, it's perfectly appropriate for the government to say that everyone has to be served equally in that, and that just because you say, I have a religious reason for wanting to exclude certain people, that doesn't avoid the basic rule that the law can protect everyone against discrimination.
Could you please touch on the issue of religious refusals and exemptions in the context of the contraceptive coverage requirement of the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, sure. As your audience will know, the Affordable Care Act includes that requirement that employers and universities that provide health insurance have to cover contraception. Now, the Obama administration exempted houses of worship from that requirement, so churches have never had to comply. Some religiously affiliated entities, colleges, hospitals, or entities like that, complained that they have religious objections and should be exempted also. So the Obama administration created an accommodation procedure. That's the technical term under First Amendment law, for which these entities could have an exemption from the requirement. They wouldn't be required to provide or pay for the coverage. The government would instead arrange for it entirely without their participation. In the Hobby Lobby case in the Supreme Court, some big but privately owned businesses said, hey, we want that too. The Supreme Court agreed. Then what happened is these religiously affiliated entities sued the government, saying that having to ask for a religious exemption from the law in order to get it wasn't good enough, because they said when we ask for it, that triggers the government's provision of the coverage, so that makes us complicit in the sin of providing coverage for contraception. They said that they should be able to exempt themselves from providing the insurance in a way that doesn't permit the government to step in and provide the care. Now, what Judge Richard Posner on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, so an incredibly well-respected Reagan-appointed conservative judge, said that that's like being a conscientious objector to the draft and saying not just that the government can't exempt me because I have a religious objection to war, but also that the government can't turn around and draft somebody else to fill the spot because that would violate my religious freedom. What Judge Posner said is that basically that just doesn't make any sense. That's not how law and government work. The other thing, and maybe the more important thing, is that the rule has always been that you don't have religious freedom rights to exemptions from the law when the effect of giving them to you is that the costs and burdens and harms get shifted onto innocent third parties. And that's what's happening here. Contraceptive coverage is enormously important. It gets to basic issues of health inequality for women. Saying that employers and universities don't have to provide or pay for the coverage, that's one thing. Saying that they get to exercise that exemption in a way that prevents their employees and students from receiving the coverage when they're supposed to be entitled to it by law, that's something altogether different. Since the Trump administration came in, the government has switched sides on this issue. Now it's put in regulations, some new regulations saying that objecting entities that don't like providing contraceptive coverage, whether for religious reasons or for moral reasons, not only that they don't have to provide or pay for it, but also that they can do it in a way that prevents the government from providing the coverage. And then the Trump-Pence administration has done a bunch of secret backroom settlement deals with these entities, saying that if the government ever puts in new laws or regulations about the coverage, they can ignore those too.
I understand that the Supreme Court just decided a case called Nifla v. Becerra, the so-called crisis pregnancy center case. The court granted cert, but only on the free speech question, not on the free exercise one. Aren't those two connected, though?
Absolutely. The case was about sham medical clinics, anti-abortion groups that set up centers, make them look like real medical facilities, and frankly, trick pregnant women into going there for health care to try to prevent the women from exercising their right to obtain an abortion. These clinics often flat out lie to patients. Any deception, any trick in the book to make sure that the pregnant women don't go someplace else and get the care that they want. These are religious entities. They're often not medical facilities at all. A lot of them don't have any medical personnel, although they make it look like they do. They have a religious agenda, not a medical one, to prevent women from having abortions.
Do you know how many such operations there are across the country?
I don't know the numbers, and probably should, but I know that there are a lot of them all across the country. In California alone, the numbers are pretty staggering, and one of the parties, NIFLA, which is the National Institute of Family Life Advocates, runs a whole network of these clinics. So we're talking about thousands and possibly tens of thousands of these clinics across the country. I use the word clinics, but that's
right.
But listen, that's not really true. Some of them, again, no doctors, no nurses, no medical training, but they pretend to be medical clinics in order to get people in the door and to trick them into not having abortions, not considering abortions, and without regard to what care the people are seeking or whether they actually get it.
Mm. Richard, can you tell us briefly about the case? I believe it's Woolley and Barnett. It's a religion case as well as a free speech case, but it was decided under the free speech clause without referencing the religious clauses.
Yeah, Woolley and Barnett are, there are two cases. West Virginia against Barnett was a case in 1943 in which some Jehovah's Witnesses, a family, challenged a West Virginia law that required students in public schools to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And this was, by the way, before the pledge had the words "under God" in it. But as Jehovah's Witnesses, they said, we can't say a pledge to the flag. That's idolatry in our faith. The Supreme Court said that it was unconstitutional under the Free Speech Clause to require the family to take a pledge that went against their religious beliefs. Woolley against Maynard was a somewhat more recent case that had to do with also a Jehovah's Witness family, this time in New Hampshire, where they objected to the words "live free or die," which is the Massachusetts state
New Hampshire.
Motto.
I'm from New Hampshire.
I'm sorry. Thank you. New Hampshire motto on the license plates. And so the family covered up the words, and they kept being prosecuted. And in fact, the husband, was put in jail a couple of times over putting a piece of tape over the words "live free or die" because the New Hampshire Supreme Court said that it violated the state law against obscuring the letters and numbers on license plates. The case got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court there again said that you have the right not to be forced in that way to carry the government's message. And again, it was really about religion, because the whole basis for not wanting to say "live free or die" was that it was a Jehovah's Witness family that believed that the motto and the message were in violation of their faith. So these are kind of classic examples of the way that the court used to recognize individual rights to be free from both religious oppression and coerced statements that go contrary to your religion if nobody else is being harmed. It doesn't hurt anybody else to say you don't have to say the Pledge of Allegiance. It doesn't hurt anybody else to put a sticker or a piece of tape over "live free or die" on a license plate. And so the court would say those are times when your religious rights trump the interests of the state. And that was what religious freedom and free speech used to mean. Now it's something else. Now it's turning religious freedom and free speech into swords to impose your views on other people rather than shields to protect your private conduct and your beliefs.
Now, Richard, let's talk about whom do these protections apply? Traditional religious freedom? I understand you have some cases involving Muslim Americans. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yeah. We've been, since the Trump-Pence administration came in and imposed its Muslim ban, its first, second, and third Muslim bans, we've been litigating those cases. And those are a traditional very much a traditional example of where the government is not supposed to be able to say, we don't like your kind because of your religion, you don't belong here, you don't get treated as equal citizens. That's what the law is supposed to be. That's what religious freedom protections are about. They're supposed to be protections for majority faith and minority faiths. One of the things that's happened, and when you, interestingly, I think when you put the Supreme Court's decision in Masterpiece Cake Shop together with the Supreme Court's recent decision in, it was called Trump against Hawaii, but the Muslim ban case that it decided, the court was incredibly troubled by the one comment by a commissioner in Colorado that I mentioned earlier, but all the, frankly, Muslim bashing that President Trump has done, both on the campaign trail and since he's been president, making clear that they don't belong here, they're not us, that didn't bother the court. That was constitutionally permissible to make our immigration policy based on that deep-seated religious bias prejudice, so that it seems like the court is sending us the message that dislike of conservative Christians, that's unconstitutional. Dislike of religious minorities, that's perfectly fine. That's not how the law is supposed to work. Religious freedom is supposed to apply to everybody. Majority faiths, minority faiths, non-believers, we're all supposed to be equally respected without regard to our faith. And that's not what's going on.
Rachel Lazar, president and CEO of Americans United, has said, quote, the separation of church and state is the only way to ensure religious freedom for all Americans. This principle could not be more vital, given that Americans belong to hundreds of different faiths, and many are non-religious. Yet all signs indicate that President Donald Trump will appoint a justice who will undermine this foundational and vital American value. Richard, talk briefly about this, if you will.
Yeah, look, the stakes couldn't be higher. What Rachel had to say is exactly right. Religious freedom is supposed to be for all of us. The Supreme Court, the courts in general, have not been consistent with that principle. This term's cases, like the Muslim ban case, and in some ways Masterpiece Cake Shop, make that clear as well. A new Supreme Court in which we're not sure what we're going to have is quite worrisome. Justice Kennedy has been considered the swing vote for quite some time. Justice Kennedy was quite protective, has been quite protective of children in public schools, making sure that religion is not imposed on them without regard to their and their family's beliefs. And he's been quite protective of the rights of LGBT people. Those issues, those rights are all at risk. And the difference between a Justice Kennedy, who is a swing vote on these issues as well as so many others, versus a justice who may come in and have the extreme view, the extreme and outside the mainstream and outside of our history view that some of the members of the court now have already, means a real threat to continuing religious freedom for all of us.
The motto, "In God We Trust,"
yes,
that we see in courthouses across the nation. I understand someone brought a challenge to that and didn't succeed. Is that an issue that many people complain about in your experience?
Yeah, we hear a lot about people being bothered by "In God We Trust," the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance, and being required to say it, and more generally about governmental sponsorship and support for religion. And I think it's worth thinking about that bigger things within that bigger frame. When government puts its thumb on the scale and says, this set of religious beliefs is one that who we are as Americans and what we favor, it makes those who don't share those beliefs outsiders. It says, you're not really one of us. It also, by the way, doesn't actually help the people who are nominally benefited. This gets back to Roger Williams that we talked about at the beginning and that you brought up rightly, is that when government puts its thumb on the scale and supports particular faiths and particular beliefs, it tends to deprive all of us of our ability to make free choices about religion and matters of faith, and it also tends to pull religious entities into political debates that aren't particularly good for them. Religion and the prophetic voice can have a profound influence for promoting social justice, and that's been enormously important. But when government gets into the business of promoting particular religious beliefs, and religions want to be the ones that are favored, they stop acting like religions. They stop being voices to make sure that the government is acting in ways that are just for all, and instead begin pandering to the government the way that the government is pandering to them. That's a relationship that is, I think, dangerous for all of our freedom.
That's beautifully put, Richard. Couldn't agree more. We are unfortunately running out of time. I wanted to ask you, is there anything in your work at Americans United that we haven't referenced that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, you know, we've hit a lot of the most pressing things that we're dealing with. A lot of our work over the past year and a half has been about the Muslim ban, about reproductive rights and the Affordable Care Act, about the rights of LGBT people and same-sex couples, the rights not to be discriminated against in the name of religion. We also do a whole bunch of litigation on, call them more traditional church-state matters, to make sure that your kids in school get an education that is not an education in religion that might be contrary to your beliefs, but that's an education that's open and available to all, that public schools are open and welcoming places to everyone, that government meetings are open and welcoming to everyone, and don't say, we like your kind or we don't like your kind based on whether you share a particular set of beliefs. So that's a big part of our work, too, as well as fighting against governmental funding for religion. And for the reasons that we've already talked about, that ends up hurting religion and forcing all of us to support with our tax dollars religious views, beliefs, actions that we may not agree with.
Richard, can you please give us the website for Americans United?
It is au.org. Very easy.
Well, it's been truly a delight, and I think a week after the 4th of July, it's especially timely to hear about your fine work. And we hope to stay in touch with you. Thank you
Wonderful.
So much.
So glad to have spoken with you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last week, an alternative 4th of July celebration in New York City commemorated Frederick Douglass and his Independence Day speech at the Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society in 1852. The event was organized by poet Raymond Nat Turner, who has been a guest on Law and Disorder, and it was held at the New York chapter of the National Writers Union on July 3rd. The celebration included performances by Upsurge New York City, Solidarity Poems, and Frederick Douglass readers, Ralph Poynter of the Lynn Stewart Organization and the New Abolitionist Movement, Margaret Kimberly from the Black Agenda Report, and Diane Ward from the National Writers Union Steering Committee. I was also honored to be the fourth reader. We are pleased to bring you some of the music, poetry, and the Frederick Douglass readings.
We have over here Ralph Poynter, who basically needs no introduction.
Fellow citizens, I am not wanting in respect for the fathers of this republic. The signers of the Declaration of Independence were brave men. They were great men, too. Great enough to give frame to a great age. It does not often happen to a nation to raise at one time such a number of truly great men. The point from which I am compelled to view them is not certainly the most favorable. And yet I cannot contemplate their great deeds with less than admiration. They were statesmen, patriots, and heroes. And for the good they did and the principles they contended for, I will unite with you to honor their memory. Fellow citizens, pardon me and allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, both for your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Why so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? Who so stolid and selfish that would not give his voice to swell the hallelujahs of a nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude had been torn from his limbs? I am not that man. In a case like that, the dumb might eloquently speak, and the lame man leap as an art. For such is not the state of the case. I say with a sad sense of the disparity between us, I am not included within the pale of glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak to you today? Thank you.
Yes, Margaret Kimberly.
Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not faithfully remember those bleeding children of sorrow this day, may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing there, identified with the American bondman, making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. Whether we turn to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity which is outraged, in the name of liberty which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce, with all the emphasis I can command, everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America. I will not equivocate, I will not excuse. I will use the severest language I can command, and yet not one word shall escape me that any man whose judgment is not blinded by prejudice or who is not at heart a slaveholder shall not confess to be right and just.
Our next reader, Diane Ward.
The present. My business, if I have any here today, is with the present. The accepted time with God and his cause is the ever-living now. Trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead past bury its dead. Act in the living present, heart within and God overhead. We have to do with the past only as we can make it useful to the present and to the future. To all inspiring motives, to noble deeds which can be gained from the past, we are welcome. But now is the time, the important time. Your fathers have lived, died, and have done their work, and you have done much of it well. You live and must die, and you must do your work. You have no right to enjoy a child's share in the labor of your fathers, unless your children are to be blessed by your labors. You have no right to wear out and waste the hard-earned fame of your fathers to cover your indolence. Sidney Smith tells us that men seldom eulogize the wisdom and virtues of their fathers, but to excuse some folly or wickedness of their own. This truth is not a doubtful one. There are illustrations of it near and remote, ancient and modern. It was fashionable hundreds of years ago for the children of Jacob to boast, "We have Abraham to our father," when they had long lost Abraham's faith and spirit. That people contented themselves under the shadow of Abraham's great name while they repudiated the deeds which made his name great. Need I remind you that a similar thing is being done now all over this country today? Need I tell you that the Jews are not the only people who built the tombs of the prophets and garnished the sepulchres of the righteous? Washington could not die till he had broken the chains of his slaves. Yet his monument is built up by the price of human blood. And the traitors in the bodies and souls of men shout, "We have Washington to our father." Alas, that it should be so, yet so it is. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence?
Hadi Boghossian.
No nation can now shut itself up from the surrounding world and trot around in the same old path of its founders without interference. The time was when such could be done. Long-established customs of hurtful character could formerly fence themselves in and do their evil work with social impunity. Knowledge was then confined and enjoyed by the privileged few, and the multitude walked on in darkness. But a change has now come over the affairs of mankind. Walled cities and empires have become unfashionable. The arm of commerce has borne away the gates of the strong city. Intelligence is penetrating the darkest corners of the globe. It makes its pathway over and under the sea, as well as on the earth. Wind, steam, and lightning are its chartered agents. Oceans no longer divide, but link nations together. From Boston to London is now a holiday excursion. Space is comparatively annihilated. Thoughts expressed on one side of the Atlantic are distinctly heard on the other. The far off and almost fabulous Pacific rolls in grandeur at our feet. The celestial empire, the mystery of ages, is being solved. The fiat of the Almighty, "Let there be light," has not yet spent its force. No abuse, no outrage, whether in taste, sport, or avarice, can now hide itself from the all-pervading light. The iron shoe and crippled foot of China must be seen in contrast with nature. Africa must rise and put on her yet unwoven garment. Ethiopia shall stretch out her hand unto God. In the fervent aspirations of William Lloyd Garrison, I say, and let every heart join in saying it, God speed the year of Jubilee, the world o'er, when from their galling chain set free, the press shall vilely bend the knee, and wear the yoke of tyranny like brutes no more. That year will come and freedom's reign, to man his plundered rights again restore. Godspeed the day when human blood shall cease to flow, in every clime be understood the claims of human brotherhood, and each return for evil, good, not blow for blow. That day will come all feuds to end, and change into a faithful friend each foe.
We go now to hear a poem by Radical Poets Collective member Fareed Bitar.
Assalamu alaikum. May peace be upon you, in case you don't know what that is. We Palestinians come in peace, and we always say that. My poem is 7 years old. I know no introduction, but we're a cause as much as the black cause in America. We're the black Palestinians' answer to the British colonials. So my poem is an answer to the British who donated my land to another people who don't have a land to come to my land. Nakba. Atinina ya wagani. Falguna. سر الوجوه وانين Give me the flute and lament. Lamenting is eternal. Gibran. I told this story so many times that I sometimes forget how it all started. Mother narrated some. I read the start. Father refrained from talking. Father refrained from talking. I lost my father a long time ago. I told the story so many times, I forget. The problem with this story is that I should build a nest for the future and the present. The problem is, I keep dwelling on my past. The other problem is, Zion keeps destroying my nest. My father's house demolished again and again in what is now called a Jewish quarter. I refrained from talking, just like Mama. Zion keeps destroying my nest. It all started a simple way. A child growing in a sleepy town, Jericho. Ariha, Ariha, Tufulati. It all started with the mentee. It all started with the rain evaporating in the hot summer nights. Qawmiyati, Atini, Huriyati, Nakba 48, 750,000 displaced, ethnically cleansed. My Naksa of 67, 430,000 ethnically cleansed. I mean displaced. I mean I need to go home. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Don't forget us. Pray for us. Pray for us in Gaza. We're under the gun. Pray for us in the West Bank. Pray for us. Pray for the children. Pray for us in Iraq and Afghanistan. Thank you.
We close with a performance by Upsurge. We are an army of artists. Let's take a listen.
Of a rose, melody in the mirror. We are an army of artists, merchants of life. Beauty's our bomb, love. It's shrapnel.
We are an army of artists, infantry on feet of celebration, toes polishing hardwood floors with our perspiration.
We are an army of artists, brandishing sticks and brushes, softening up with strokes and notes. Partisans wielding pastels, oils, and acrylics. Connecting dots, hitting spots on canvas and paper.
We are an army of artists. Foreign fighters, formerly known as dukes, counts, birds, pops. Militant magi weaving dreams in azure skies. Etching prayers in mirrors with our acid tears.
Asymmetrical warriors mopping up murals gracing broken down buildings. Enemy combatants crying clear lacquer on contrabasses. Snipers shooting sunlight into hearts held hostage by the 1%. Tonia is our tonic for subdominant dreams.
We are an army of artists, dangerously unselfish, enemies of ignorance, drumming to different dancers in theaters,
staging attacks.
Loading in a pause. Tapestry cut from the same cloth. Nicknames notwithstanding, their name is Legion, the father of his country, the sage of Monticello, the father of the Constitution, Old Hickory, Oh, Rough and Ready, Mr. Missouri, Bubba, The Little Magician, Slick Willie, Tricky Dick, W, but Legend Baines Johnson resonated deepest. Until Jesus Christ came back from a manger on Madison Avenue as an organizer of sleeping car porters rejecting George. Not as a socialist speaking truth to lunch bucket crowds in Harlem. Not as a pistol packing terrorist pointing her people at the North Star. Not as a bearded old white extremist uncomfortable with slavery. Not as a Muslim minister spitting fire at mass murderers posing as victims. Not as a Baptist preacher pinning the emperor's clothes on fine lines of love. Jesus Christ came back. Temptation walking the Potomac to beauty's only skin deep, yeah, yeah, yeah. And calibrating his cover story. Rosa sat so Martin could stand, so the state machine could run amok with bloody precision. Jesus Christ came back, forgiving thieves and murderers escaping Calvary aboard Pontius Pilate's helicopter and old Satan's wheelchair. Came back overturning tables in the temple and throwing money changers out with trillions in dollars. Came back teaching men to fish for tarp, multiplying like loaves.
That was a spoken word piece performed by Upsurge at the Alternative 4th of July celebration in New York City, commemorating Frederick Douglass and his Independence Day speech.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.